Hospice and palliative medicine are incredible team sports, all centered around the patient and the family. Our goal is to create a safety net underneath that patient and family and let them know not much can happen that we collectively haven't seen and or have the resources to help you get through this.
Everybody's experience is unique, but there are these patterns and these places that everyone will, I guarantee, walk. And we've walked those paths.
Hi again. Welcome to another episode of This Day and Age, where we bring together experts in all things aging from Holland Home, Faith Hospice, and of course, Atria Home Care. We do this to give you important information to help you and your loved ones navigate this thing called life and make informed and confident decisions along the way. I'm your host, Phil Tower. It's been an incredible pleasure to be here for every one of these episodes of This Day and Age. We're fortunate in this episode to be joined by two heavyweights. They've got fitting nicknames, but they are Dr. Patrick Fitzgibbon, Medical Director of Faith Hospice and Trillium Palliative Services. He's to my left if you are playing and scoring at home. And Dr. Jason Beckrow is to my right, hospice and palliative care specialist, heretofore known. Dr. Beckrow will be Dr. J. Dr. Fitzgibbon will be Dr. Fitz. Good for you guys? We're good with those established ground rules?
That sounds pretty good.
Perfect.
Thanks, Phil.
First of all, welcome. Thank you really for being here.
Thank you.
This is one of those topics. I was mentioning this before we started this episode today, that we don't like to think about until we have to think about it. You guys chose to dive straight into it, so I give you a lot of credit for that. First of all, Dr. Beckrow, Dr. J, you started in oncology but transitioned to hospice and palliative care. Was there a focus on that, or a driving factor for that?
I think there's a lot of factors into that evolution. And first of all, Phil, thank you very much for having us here today and the opportunity to talk with you and your audience. I was drawn to oncology for a number of reasons. One, people going through incredibly, you know, think about the phrase, you've just been diagnosed with cancer, and all the turmoil that goes along with that, and the opportunity to help people in that time was what I was really drawn to. And I was really fortunate that I had great trainers that helped me understand, you know, thankfully, more than half of our patients today will become long-term survivors. That was not always the case. But at the time when I was training, it was much closer to 50-50, which meant about half would not become long-term survivors. And I had really great trainers that helped me understand that that's not when we turn our back on our patients and say there's nothing we can do, but that's when we do our most important work. And that's how I got connected with the hospice movement, as it were. And we're going to talk a lot more about palliative medicine, but that's how I, you know, was my intro, entree, say, to hospice care.
Dr. Fitzgibbon, what attracted you to this specialty?
Phil, I'm a living example of God choosing the foolishness of the world to confound the wise. So I didn't start medical school until I was in my mid-30s. And in my mid-20s, I watched both of my parents die, and this was 35 or 40 years ago. And at that time, hospice was just evolving, and they didn't have the benefit of hospice. And there were well-meaning people involved in their care, but it was raw. And again, there was no hospice involvement. So when I completed medical school, or as I matriculated, I intended to be a family doctor. And I was going to be the small town doc on the sidelines at the football games on Friday nights. And during my residency training, at the very beginning of that, I ran into a gentleman named Dr. John Mulder. And he took me under his wing and apprenticed me. And by the time I finished my training, I was doing a lot of hospice work on the side, in addition to geriatrics work, working with people 65 and older, and I had my family practice as well. And very quickly, within a year or two, I was blessed to be able to transition right into geriatrics and hospice, and then over the past 10 or 12 years into full-time hospice work. So a long answer to a short question. I think it was God and his providence leading me down a path and having some significant personal experience, and then some divine providence in meeting people who shepherded me along the road.
That's a great story, and Dr. Mulder may have been one of God's angels on earth pointing you in that direction. There's an amazing thing about a person that you mentor under, someone who has a passion for any specific area, including medicine, that seems to be a very infectious thing and really inspires a lot of great people behind them, which is a wonderful thing. I love that story. I'm so glad you were here because we need to unpack these two very important topics. And really, again, every one of these episodes is about empowering people to make better decisions, to not go through it like you did. You said something also, and I want to share this with our listeners. Hospice is a new concept in this country, barely 50 years old. Hmm. It blew me away when you said that.
Yeah, it started in England. It was the brainchild of Dame Cicely Saunders. To very quickly give you a synopsis of this amazing woman's life, she was at Oxford before World War II studying to become a social worker. And the war arrived, and she became a nurse during the war. She fell in love with a Polish freedom fighter who died, and that was a significant experience for her during the war. You know, a lot went on at that time. Mm-hmm. The war finished, and she went back to Oxford and completed her social work degree. So now she's a social worker and a nurse. She subsequently lost another person she was in love with and suffered some additional personal losses, and she went to medical school and became a doctor. She became a physician as well. So by the late 50s, she's not only a nurse, she's a social worker, she's a doctor. She grew up during World War I and suffered all of that loss. She was an adult, a young adult, during World War II and suffered those losses, and she suffered these personal losses. And out of that, she came to understand that medicine, as we practice it in the West, its technological reach was exceeding its moral and ethical grasp. And she came up with this idea of hospice.
A powerful realization.
Yes, and started St. Christopher's Hospice in London in the early 60s. It would have been in the early 60s. And I think by the mid to late 60s, she was knighted and became Dame Cicely, Cecilia Saunders. And then people saw what was going on over there, and it crossed the pond and came this way. And in 1974, that's when we know that the first hospices began to open up at a grassroots level in the United States and in Canada. And it was a grassroots movement. There weren't any folks in the ivory tower doing this. The one university system that was involved initially, that still is involved, was the University of Wisconsin, and there's still a flag bearer for this. But that's the story.
And now it is a specialization that a doctor can choose, someone entering the medical field.
Correct. And, we'll elaborate on this a little bit further, Dr. Beckrow will. But to kind of paint a picture, you have palliative medicine, which is the overarching rubric. And then under that, you have hospice care and palliative care. And generally speaking, palliative care comes first in a person's experience and then hospice care. But it's important to make those two distinctions. So the field as a whole is palliative medicine, and it's subdivided into hospice care and palliative care.
So palliative care, Dr. J, it comes before hospice, typically. It is different, but it has similarities. Help us understand those.
Sure. Palliative comes from the roots to palliate, to relieve suffering. And think of palliative medicine, the goal is, again, the relief of suffering in whatever form that may be. A very small subset of that, or not very small, but a relatively small subset of that is pure palliation at the end of life, which is what is hospice care. And I think a lot of your listeners will be very familiar with hospice care, very end of life, helping our loved ones transition peacefully and with minimal pain from this life to the next. But that is, as Dr. Fitz mentioned, a subset of what palliative medicine is. To relieve suffering, suffering can be in many, many forms. Many of us will think of the concept of pain and suffering, so we are well trained in how to manage acute and chronic pain. But suffering can come in many other fashions, and I will speak a lot from the, say, cancer experience. A person who is diagnosed with cancer today, no matter where they were yesterday, is all of a sudden thinking about life in a very different thinking about, amongst other things, their demise in a much more objective rather than abstract fashion. And with that comes existential suffering, perhaps spiritual suffering, if there's estrangement in the family, social suffering. Can I afford these treatments? Financial suffering. The goal of palliative medicine is to address suffering in any form it may be, physical, social, what have you, and then walk the journey with that patient, ideally from the time of diagnosis to the time of cure. But if cure is not possible for any life-limiting or life-altering illness, to walk that journey and address the suffering in whatever form that may be.
And you had mentioned previously goals of care.
Yeah.
This is something that we build upon case after case after case. This is not something, Dr. Fitz, Dr. J, that we just kind of look at somebody and go, I think this will work. There's actually a playbook, just like there is for an NFL team. And you've built upon that experience, whether it's the beginning of palliative care or hospice care. Fair enough to say?
Absolutely. When we talk about goals of care, usually in Western medicine, we would assume the goal would be to not die. And most of the time, that's going to be both accurate and what the patient would choose and what all parties would choose for the patient. But there are times when there can be suffering where dying is not necessarily the worst outcome. And again, that's when we transition closer to hospice care, to recognize that. As a medical oncologist, I need to be very mindful as I, you mentioned the word empowerment. My phrase in practice has always been educating, empowering, healing. My job as a physician is first and foremost is to be a teacher. Help people understand where they're at, what their options are, and then empower them to make the choices that are right for them, which may be different for a patient today than it will be tomorrow, different at this stage of life as an alternate stage of life. For the patient in room one, may be different for the patient in room two. My job is not to come in with a pejorative sense of what is right and wrong. I educate and empower them to make the appropriate choices. And with that comes the opportunity then for planning. So again, the patient, our ultimate goal is the patient feels a sense of empowerment to make the choices right for them at whatever stage they may be.
Dr. Fitzgibbon, a patient may have a cancer diagnosis, and this is important and we understand this. Some diagnoses may give an outlook of, yes, you may be cured, and this may be a long journey. Maybe it's a 2-year to 5-year journey, perhaps shorter. When do you begin the discussion of palliative care along that journey and then eventually hospice? If you can help our listeners understand from a timeline, and we'll just use, obviously every patient is different, but we'll use an average case you may have had and walk us through that process, if you will.
So Dr. J will help me out here, but I'm going to piggyback a little bit on what he said. And so what he's describing is palliative medicine. I'll give you a definition I use. And both Dr. J and I teach for Michigan State, and so we work with their residents and students and fellows. And often I will tell the students as they try to understand what palliative medicine is, that really in a nutshell, it's two things. It's very simple. It's symptom management in chronic end stage disease. Simple, right? Helping with breathing or pain or emotional distress or intellectual distress, spiritual distress, but covering the whole person. But we're working on these symptoms. So symptom management and end stage chronic disease. And the second part of this is, simply put, goals of care discussions. But if you want to paint a mental picture of who and what that is, think of the palliative doctor or the nurse as your trail guide through the wilderness. And it's a trail that they have guided many, many other people through. And the experience is unique to every person, but there are patterns and there are places on the trail that we've tread 100 times, if not 1,000 times. And we're usually 1 to 2 steps ahead. And why walk that without a guide? So that's what those goals of care discussions are, and all the planning. So I'll tell you a quick vignette. A couple of years ago, I got a call on a Friday night around 10 o'clock. And it was from a woman who's a friend of mine. She and her husband are dear friends. Our kids grew up together, and they're like family. And her name was Sally. So Sally calls at 10 o'clock at night, and she's distressed. And she says, "Fitz, I'm over here on the east side. I'm with my sister. She's at home. She's dying of breast cancer. The whole family is here. And she is in incredible pain, and she's delirious and agitated, and we don't know what to do. And she is, my friend Sally, is obviously distressed." And I said, "Okay, well, where's your palliative service? Where's your hospice nurse? Who's helping you?" "Well, we don't have anybody. No one was offered." "So you were never offered this service." "Okay. Well, I tried to talk her through it and help her as best I could. And then when I hung up the phone, I sat back and I thought, would we do this to someone who was pregnant? Would we say to you, 'Oh, congratulations, you're pregnant. Good luck.
See you in 40 weeks.
And see you in 40 weeks and you deliver this on your own. Your family will help you. You'll be good.'"
Is this a contemporary story?
Oh, this happens all the time. I can name major metropolitan areas where I have close friends who have trained in our fellowship, who cannot get the hospital systems there to support a palliative program. One city in particular I know of has two hospitals. It's that sizable, and there is no palliative program in either hospital.
The silence was purposeful. I am stunned. What you have just described is wrong. It's unfathomable in this country, this most modernized country in the world we live in. And it points at something I wanted to get at, because I lived through this with my father-in-law a long time ago, who died from bladder cancer, who suffered exactly what Sally was talking about, that pain, indescribable, loss of control, hallucinations. It scared the daylights out of everyone in the room, including his wife and me, the son-in-law, sitting there watching this for the first time in my fairly mature adult life. I was probably in my 30s at the time, but I just was blown away, thinking, this does not seem right.
We're really fortunate in West Michigan that we have a really robust palliative medicine culture. And a lot of communities don't.
Now, granted, this was some 20 years ago. It's a long time ago. But I think what you just described, Dr. Fitz, is why so many people are fearful of this whole conversation of palliative care and hospice care. You wanted to say something, Dr. J.
I think a lot of this just comes down to awareness. And what Dr. Fitz is describing for us, we've been able to see over the last 20 years both improvement, but yet we're a long ways to where we need to be. I really love how Dr. Fitz referred to the role played as a trailblazer, trail guide.
It's a great term.
Oftentimes you will use nautical metaphors and navigators. You know, we talk a lot about the concept of forks in the road. As Dr. Fitz mentions, you know, when a person is diagnosed with a particular disease, we as physicians and our teams have a understanding of what that trajectory looks like and various forks in the road. And that's where you educate and empower your patients so that they can seek healing on whatever choice is right for them. But our goal, like Fitz mentioned, is to always be at least a couple steps ahead. Anticipate those forks in the road. You're just completed your first cycle of chemotherapy and things went well. Fantastic. Now you've got a disease relapse. We're going to second and third line therapies, and now you're having severe side effects. That's a fork in the road. Which direction we want to go? We want to double down on the treatments, or is this the time to maybe hit the pause button, recover from the treatment so that the patient can achieve those goals? Most people, if they know that time is limited, they would choose to do a lot of things other than go to the doctor's office. And Fitz and I see it very
a high degree of responsibility as medical professionals, helping our patients know where they're at so they can make those choices, again, when appropriate for them to do so. And one last thing I'd like to piggyback on. There was a monumental study that came out around 2010. It was a group at Mass General in Boston. And they asked the question, if keep in mind, when there's a lack of awareness of what palliative medicine is, and if there's confusion that it's only hospice care, therefore only end of life, the referrals get made, if at all, toward the very end. So this group, led by Dr. Jennifer Tamil, said, what if we give everybody with advanced lung cancer the option of a palliative medicine consultation at the beginning of treatment, not at the end? Those folks that opted in, their symptoms were better managed. Their suffering as far as depression, anxiety, spiritual distress, existential stress, those were all improved. By knowing that they had choices, they actually consumed less chemotherapy. And here's the kicker. They actually lived longer. And that's when we started asking, wow, at what point do our treatments become worse than the disease itself? And are we empowering our patients to hit the pause button? Again, that's the phrase I like to use. I don't like the word stop, right? We're Americans. We don't quit. Nobody quits. Pause is very different. Yeah. But it's, again, it's about empowerment and what can one do when they're, you know, hitting that pause button. But Fitz, thank you for making that point. We are navigators. We're trail guides, helping people anticipate and then empower them to make choices that are right for them.
Well, not only that, I'm so glad you said that. And it's a great opportunity for me to, as I'm so engrossed with this conversation, for me to let our listeners know that that was the voice of Dr. Jason Beckrow, hospice and palliative care specialist. Also with us, Dr. Patrick Fitzgibbon, medical director for Faith Hospice and Trillium Palliative Services, both here in Grand Rapids. And we are unpacking and helping you feel more empowered with regard to everything that encompasses palliative care and hospice care. And let's jump right into that when it happens where you have a loved one who, unlike Sally's very close friend, is put on hospice care and walking through that process. But I want to stop for a moment because, as we do so frequently, these are live conversations that we record and share with you. Dr. Fitz shared something that was so important that I want to stop and share with our listeners. That is, how do you make sure you are an empowered patient or family with that patient, Dr. Fitz, to make sure you're not sent home with no hospice or palliative care conversation? Can you request that even if a hospital system doesn't offer that? Or should you even go a step before that and not even enter a hospital like that if you have the choice?
It's your right as a patient to ask for a palliative consult. And it would behoove anyone to do that. Jason, can you jump on this? You might have some.
And I would think today, whereas maybe a quarter century ago, it was maybe there's a lot more aversion from the medical community. I think there's a lot more appreciation for the work that our colleagues do. And it might just be a lack of resources. So not only do you have the right to ask, if there are no resources there, hopefully that team would then be helping you get plugged in to where you can find local resources. Most communities that may not have palliative medicine would have hospice services. And if all else fails, that's kind of why we're here, you know, at the Trillium Institute, to make sure that everybody, wherever you live, get the same access to this type of care, be it in Grand Rapids, Michigan, or isn't there a Grand Rapids, South Dakota, or Minnesota, or wherever it may be.
Right. Right. So this process begins. A patient is put on hospice care. They're curious. So their families are curious how the decision is made and how the process begins.
So I'm trying to think of a good example. Perhaps your 92-year-old mother falls at home and suffers a hip fracture, and she winds up in the emergency room. and the mortality rate for surgery in a case like that is pretty high. So in that case, within certain systems, within most systems, fortunately, the emergency room doctor might ask for a palliative consult. If you sense that there's some indecision with respect to the orthopedic surgeon, the emergency room doctor, the admitting hospital physician, you're always free to ask for the palliative care team. Is there a palliative care team? I need help trying to decide what course of action we take. Now, let's say that in this situation, there's some other things going on, maybe a little heart failure or some renal failure, and so everybody agrees, the physicians involved agree that this is not a good situation, and probably mom isn't going to live 6 months. And so in their mind, they think, okay, this is appropriate for a hospice consult. At that point, they make the hospice consult, and if you know the hospice you want to have involved, you can name it. Otherwise, they will often give you some options, and you select your option. And most hospices have a nurse liaison on site 24 hours a day who will show up in the emergency room to begin discussions with you. If this is something you decide you want to do, then the attending physician on site will sign a certification statement, and the hospice physician on call will sign a certification statement. Now the candy store is open. And forgive me, that's the best example I can use, because you would ask yourself, well, why even have hospice involved? Well, because to me, it's like, I don't know if candy store is the best example, or a supermarket, or a hardware store, because now suddenly you have access to all sorts of resources. Mm-hmm. So every hospice by law has a chaplain. They have a social worker, they have a physician, they have nurse practitioners, they have RNs, they have aides, they have volunteer coordinators. In the hospice I'm with, we have 150 to 200 volunteers doing anything you could think of to help you out. You have a dedicated pharmacist, you have a bereavement coordinator, you have this whole team of people who is suddenly on your side. Not only do you have one trail guide, you now have 10 trail guides.
Yes. Yeah.
And there is nothing new under the sun, Ecclesiastes says. And like I said, everybody's experience is unique, but there are these patterns and these places that everyone will, I guarantee, walk. And we've walked those paths.
Sometimes the most profound experiences our patients and families will mention, you mentioned volunteers, just having someone come in to sit with, imagine kind of the stereotypical couple that's been married for 60 plus years. Perhaps, you know, statistically, it's a dying gentleman who's maybe a couple years older than his relatively frail wife. The wife is trying to take care of her husband. She took a vow 65 years ago to take care of them in sickness and in health. Having a volunteer just simply come in to stay with the patient while the wife is allowed to have a few hours of free time, maybe get her hair done, go get some groceries, just little things like that that we don't think about. The little things can be so huge. And I'm glad Dr. Fitz mentioned that whole interdisciplinary team that we work with. Hospice and palliative medicine are incredible team sports.
Yeah.
All centered around the patient and the family. Our goal is to create a safety net underneath that patient and family, and let them know not much can happen that we collectively haven't seen and or have the resources to help you get through this.
And these amazing teams, as you just described, Dr. Fitz, these have been developed, refined, improved, added on. Every aspect has been tweaked for maximum efficiency, comfort. As you said, all these levels of stress, you now have that trail guide for so many aspects, a chaplain, because this is a wonderful community of very strong people of faith and faith institutions. That is a big part of this. Yet, it is something that I think when people go into this area, they're so fearful. Anxiety takes over. They're so fearful, and they forget that this is built into that. And it's why you want to be thinking about this proactively. We haven't even had this conversation as we are having this really important and helpful discussion on hospice and palliative care. the beauty, Drs. Fitz and Dr. J, is that this can happen early enough where you just say, okay, we got this.
And that is, in fact, our goal. If we do this well, we'll move that relationship upstream. Patients and families will experience the benefits of a hospice interdisciplinary team or a palliative medicine team earlier, and ideally have a greater sense of, again, autonomy and empowerment at those latter stages of life.
So in its essence, hospice is not about death. Palliative medicine is not about death. It's about maximizing life.
Amen.
And I'll go on my soapbox very quickly here. Forgive
me.
Please do. But in our country, we live in a state of denial. The day you're born, you're terminal. And we're a youth-oriented culture, and we don't like to think about it. And in fact, we run from it.
I'm so glad you said that. It needs to be said, because I was thinking about that 92-year-old in ER. Three or four family members are going to rush to ER and say, no, 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 we can operate.
It's maybe dark physician humor, but I like to say that the only specialists who truly understand our mortality are the nephrologists, the kidney doctors, because the day you're born, you're in stage one renal failure, which to me would imply that, you know, death is coming soon. I'm in failure, yeah. And you've classified me. So we live in a state of denial. We should live every day, every hour, as if it's our last, and embrace it and make the most of it. And I think we would be a much kinder, gentler society if we truly understood the brevity of our life. So I go back to what we do. We're really fortunate. We work in this culture, in this place of end of life and chronic disease. We of all people should understand the brevity of life and its importance. And we of all people should be able to help others maximize their life, going back to my original point. Dr. J and I are really fortunate. All fields of medicine have this beautiful power where you're in a field, you're in a calling where you get to help people, right? There's really should be no personal inappropriate gain, right? We all, most of us, went into this because we really love people and care about people and want to help them. And we wound up in a discipline, whether it was oncology or family medicine and ultimately hospice and palliative medicine, where we just want to help. So when a person comes onto hospice or they walk into a palliative clinic, you're going to be taken care of by someone who is completely and totally on your side. It doesn't mean that sometimes there won't be a little friction as you try to understand the trail they're trying to walk you down, or as you're trying as a provider, as a physician or nurse practitioner, to understand how they want to walk it. That's okay. You know, a little bit of that tension is fine. But ultimately, Dr. J and I, we are so blessed to do this because, again, we get to do something where we are just here to help.
Yeah. I agree with that, and we are very fortunate. And many of us who come to this work kind of have our own story. And I think, Dr. Fitz, tell me if you agree or disagree, that I think we're experiencing a greater sense of awareness because just as we've had personal experiences, the people we've cared for, their family members have had those same experiences. Phil, you kind of opened up that you and your family have been through an experience that will probably make you think much more proactively and how these benefits can help both my loved one, myself someday.
Yeah.
You will probably talk to your family members, what would you want? And that gets into the whole concept of advanced care planning and whatnot. But if we do this well, it's the opportunity to take everything. Fitz and I were scientists first and foremost, but the opportunity to take that science and sprinkle in some psychology, some, you know, we are, for those, we get to think about spirituality. You know, people that are facing their mortality are thinking about life's big questions in a much more direct and less abstract way. And we have so many opportunities to offer assistance. We find that very gratifying and satisfying. And most importantly, if we do it well, when the person has passed on, the family is left with a sense there's the grief of having lost their loved one, but that was the best it could have been under these circumstances. And those folks that helped us, wow, we want to make sure all families get that opportunity. And I think we're in the midst of that now with the upswing of awareness. Thus, let's keep moving it upstream. So it's not the last 3 days, but ideally, you know, think about what you could do in 3 months if you had that same sort of mojo, if you will.
Well, an amazing thing is, as I'm hearing you both talk with an eloquence and a beauty and a simplicity I've never heard, that this wasn't you guys 30 years ago. This came on that road as part of that trail guide team. And my God, anybody who has someone like you on their team is just incredibly fortunate, blessed. I do want to address one, and we're running out of time, so just for brevity, sake of brevity, please address this as concisely as you can. There are loved ones that are going to say, I don't want to accept this diagnosis. Mm-hmm. The ones who think, well, come on, Dr. Fitz, you've got this amazing toolbox. Why can't you cure Grandpa, or why can't you cure my dad? It's hard for them to expect the fact that when they were going to born, they're going to die. They have, you know, whatever it is, renal failure, whatever, it's going to hit you at some point. And we've addressed this before in previous episodes. It is hard to sometimes lovingly and compassionately look at someone who doesn't believe that this is going to happen. And I just like you both just at the most simple way address that. And I know it's not a fair way to ask that question, but how do you handle that? And just words of wisdom for our listeners who may have someone like that in their family, or an adult parent listening to us right now who may have an adult child who's having a difficult time accepting that. Dr. Fitz?
We're constantly humbled in medicine because we admit that sometimes we can be wrong. So the first thing that leaps to my mind, and Dr. J will probably have something more profound to say, but the first thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, signing on to hospice doesn't mean that you can't graduate from hospice. Sometimes people just need close care and in a good routine that this group of people I described earlier can provide to you to get you over the hump. And then you graduate and you go on with your life. Sometimes it turns out differently than everyone anticipated. I've seen that on more than one occasion. And I know too, sometimes if your loved one, your mom, your dad, whoever, has been in and out of the hospital, and every time they said you weren't going to make it, but mom made it, and here she is 2 years later, and you keep telling me this, so why would I believe you now? But it never hurts to have that team there, or just to have the discussion. That's what leaps to my mind. But again, Dr. J's a much more deep and profound man than myself.
Well, I think you did a great job.
I
with
do
that
too.
Answer.
Absolutely, and I'll see this a lot in the inpatient setting. You know, patients in the ICU, a lot going on, and kind of like you described, everyone can kind of see how this story is likely going to end, except for, and oftentimes it's the long-lost family member who flew out, usually we always say from California, someone from, I kind of do the same thing that Dr. Fitz mentioned. Educating and empowering modality, it's our responsibility to help the patient and family know exactly where they are and what's the likelihood of that going north, going south, staying on the same path. And that's exactly when I'll say, listen, especially when I'm giving some really dire prognostication. In my business, I love to be wrong. And I'll tell them stories how I have been wrong. But what I will also tell them is, if I'm not wrong, your loved one will not be with us in a relatively short amount of time. If that time is limited, what would you choose to do to take advantage of that time? And if a week from now I'm wrong, I would love nothing more than, you know, I run into you at Meijer and you look at me like, what the heck was that guy thinking? In my business, that's a good thing. And so with that humility, I think that's another thing. A lot of humility takes to practice this type of medicine.
Well said. Dr. Fitz, Dr. J, thank you so much. I am basically speechless, except I have to wrap this up.
Phil, can I say one thing?
Absolutely. Sorry. Absolutely. And I am going to give you a chance for just a closing thought or two. Please.
Be my closing thought, just real quick. Sorry.
Yeah, of course.
I think I speak for Dr. J. If there's anybody listening and you've had a loved one on hospice and for some reason that hospice failed you, we want to apologize and we want to let you know that we're acutely aware when we fail. We're not perfect. And we try to connect and do our best for people. And sometimes we make mistakes. So because you had an experience with hospice a year ago, 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, don't throw it out and don't reconsider it, because everybody makes mistakes. Everybody fails. We all try to do better. I just have a feeling maybe there might be somebody listening who would have that feeling.
And I'm glad you addressed that. Dr. J, final thoughts, words of wisdom?
Again, thank you for the opportunity to increase awareness. Our goal is that all patients in the United States, again, wherever you are, you have access to all these services, so you can be fully educated where you're at, what your options are, empowered to make the choices that are right for you. And if we do this well, or to Dr. Fitz's point, if we do it better tomorrow than we're currently doing it today.
Right.
I was very fortunate. My dad, who I lost very early in life, was part of the reason I became a doctor and probably has been drawn to this field. But he said, you know, Jay, learn from your mistakes. Not if you make a mistake, learn from it. He said, learn from your mistakes. We all make mistakes. If we learn from it, then that can have very positive meaning. So let's continue to do better tomorrow than we're doing today. So, Phil, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
And thank you. I cannot think of two better people to have on my team. I'm so honored and touched by this opportunity. Dr. Patrick Fitzgibbon, Medical Director, Faith Hospice and Trillium Palliative Services. And that voice you just heard, Dr. Jason Beckrow, Hospice and Palliative Care Specialist. And I may add, two superbly wonderful human beings who get this like few others do. And you know what? That's why we do this podcast. We're here to empower you. We're here to just have you share a couple of moments and learn with some of the best people in the world who happen to be right here in this whole spectrum of life within Holland Home, Faith Hospice, and Atria Home Care. It's a pretty cool thing. Most importantly, if after listening to this, you or a loved one are empowered to say, okay, Dr. Fitz gave me the challenge, I'm going to pick up the phone, or maybe Dr. J, and I'm going to learn more about this hospice thing. I'm going to be proactive, and I'm going to do that. Faith Hospice is always here to help. I cannot think of better people for that first phone call. And a phone call, as my disclaimer in my script said, is not a commitment to start services. It's a commitment to feel empowered and to start that conversation. And their number, because I know you're not telepathic, is 616-235-5113. I said that faster than you could Google it or ask Siri. Again, I'll give it to you, 616-235-5113, or even better, you can pick up your phone or your tablet or your laptop, faithhospicecare.org, faithhospicecare.org, to learn more. And that puts the wraps on this very special episode of This Day and Age. I'm Phil Tower. Thank you so much for listening.